Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. Once again, here we are. We find ourselves in the middle of some of the strangest things I've ever seen. Recently, on the Jersey Shore, we had a high school, a very good high school, a nice place, affluent community for the most part, football team, football program that was wins lots of state titles and championships and really good people. I know a lot of people that attended that school. Well, recently there was a allegation that came to light that there was hazing on the football team in the locker room. Now you say to yourself, really? Hazing in a high school locker room in this day and age? Well, we know that these things go on. Unfortunately, they go on and they can be devastating to the people involved. In this particular case, it is shocking. The allegations came out that older players on the team, seniors, juniors, had attacked sophomore boys, including one particular boy that what they're saying now was that he was threatened with a broomstick. Other reports are saying he was actually sexually assaulted with the broomstick. Now you say to yourself, that seems almost impossible. In our modern world, when these things have happened before, this is not the first time that we've had hazing in a high school locker room where coaches have lost their jobs, players have been arrested, people are sent scurrying for the hills trying to figure out how they can deal with this kind of an allegation. But yet here it is again. Now, the subject of the attack, a young man who's obviously under 18, so his name has not been released. He's a victim in this case. And then the accused. Well, you would think it's bad enough that that comes out. Well, then apparently there are two more sexual assaults that took place in the school, and these are of female students. Well, as it turns out, the rumor has it, and I don't know all the facts. I know rumors from people who were there, and I don't want to spread gossip, so I would never spread a name if I didn't have a name. But the reality is, what I'm being told, it's all the same student that did the hazing and the sexual assault with a broomstick on a player, and the same one who assaulted the two females in the school. Several years ago, there was a very, very similar kind of an assault that took place here in New Jersey. And you say, is this limited to New Jersey? Is this a New Jersey-centric phenomenon of football players sexually assaulting other football players with broomsticks, broom handles? And then you find out that this is in lore. This is out there. There's other places where this has happened. And for one, I don't get it. I don't get it. I could understand, initiation rites into any kind of a group. There's initiation rites. Some are silly. Some are filled with pomp and circumstance. Others are just downright dumb. But when it comes to this kind of a thing, this kind of a hazing, this college, this high school hazing where, you have to drink a gallon of beer every half an hour for 3 hours. Well, you kill somebody. You can have somebody drink a gallon of water every half an hour and you'll kill them because that upsets your body's electrolytes, having that much water in your system. But this assaulting each other, and so far three coaches have been removed, and there's arguments going on here that the coaches shouldn't have been removed because they didn't know it was happening. They certainly didn't condone anything like this. But the bottom line is, aren't they responsible for what goes on in their locker room? How come they weren't in the locker room to monitor this, or at least have someone assigned to monitor this? So when this happened several years ago, I saw it and I started to realize that when you have these coaches, most times the coaches are teachers, or someone who really likes the sport, whatever it is, racquetball, football, baseball, whatever it is, they hire a coach, usually a teacher, to be the coach, and it's extra money for the teacher. sometimes you have people who are specialized in that kind of a sport, and they can be really crazy to do those kind of things. But in this particular case, where people are being assaulted, especially sexually assaulted, I wrote this article about it. And my whole idea was, why don't we do something in the beginning of the school year in every school in America where the coaches call their team together and they explain this to them? You know, because we think these kids know it. We think they would never do something like this. But we have to say, if the coaches aren't responsible, and that's not what's happening here, these three coaches have been suspended, they're probably not going to come back. Because the way people see it is that if you're the coach and the coaching team, it is your responsibility to know what is right and what is wrong, and to know that what's going on in your locker room. Do you know what's going on in your locker room? You should know, or you should post somebody there. Well, when we look at this, we say, if they had this meeting at the beginning of the year, they'd say, hi, gentlemen, ladies, whoever you have on your team, whatever you got. And you say, listen, hazing is inappropriate. Initiation is done on the field when a player plays really, really well. But assaulting each other, hitting each other, touching each other, making people drink things that they don't want to drink, making them do anything, and assaulting anyone in any way is completely and totally inappropriate. Now, that sounds so basic and so simple, but it keeps happening. It keeps happening all across this country at schools everywhere. And you know what? As bad as this is, it's going to happen again. Why? And like I said, I don't understand it. I played high school sports. I never had an inclination to do anything like this. And I just really don't understand people who do. But it's one of those things that are out there. So in one of our previous episodes, I started outlining and talking about leadership and how important leadership is in our country. And I'm probably going to follow along with that a little bit in our time together today. Because I look at this instance where these coaches have been removed. And that's the argument that's raging around here in these communities where this happened. Some people are saying, well, it's certainly not the coach's fault at all because the coach didn't know. And other people are saying, it doesn't matter if the coach knows. The coach is responsible. So I don't know where you stand on it. I kind of fall on the fact that the coach is responsible all day long, every day. If it was my kid in that locker room and that happened, I would be outraged that nobody had been paying attention to what was going on in there. Were there rumors about it? Was there talk about it? Did you know anything about this this student who had done these other things? You know, schools very, very often will shut down very quickly any rumor mill or any kind of a problem. And we see it all across the country where a lot of places, schools don't report assaults. They don't report. Even right there in Virginia, where the young man wearing a skirt assaulted a female student in the girls' bathroom. This was Loudoun County, I believe it was, just recently. And it was all over the news. Well, this young man, and I'm not trying to genderize him or any of those things. I'm just saying, they're saying it that it's a young man in a dress. And of course, the big thing that was going on in Loudoun County at the time is that the school board was pushing very hard for regendering all of this and having transgender bathrooms, and anybody can go in any bathroom. And you know, that argument that's going on in our country, it's going on in many of our schools. It might be going on in your school right now. But whatever happened, this young man sexually assaulted a girl in the bathroom, and then they didn't report it, they didn't make a big deal of it, and they just simply moved this person to another school where he sexually assaulted another person, another girl. We have to have this transparency. We can't have these kind of things going on in our schools. And I just wanted to mention that because I'm just shocked by it, because it does seem like a very good school. And I know, you know, I teach about investigative things, and we look and we say, you know, oh, that's such a nice man. He would never do anything. And he has three heads in his refrigerator, right? Oh, he was such a nice guy. I couldn't believe he's a serial killer and he ate four of his neighbors. You know, these things go on in every location. You have people that will do strange, evil, bad things. But it's something we want to consider as we go forward. Maybe there should be a program each and every year at the start of every sporting season, whatever it is, where we just remind everyone. You know, we don't haze people, we don't tease people, we don't harass people, and we certainly don't assault people with broomsticks sexually in the locker room, right? Common sense. Let's talk about that. But it's a leadership concern, right? Is it a leadership concern? Where were the leaders on the team? Did they know about it? Did they come forward and say anything? Did they say something was brewing? The coaches are leaders. Where's the leadership of the school to not come forward and tell everyone right away? I don't know. I'm going to try and weave this in as we go forward. And maybe I'll talk a little bit more later on. In a previous episode, I told you I had two examples of great leaders. And we talked about one, Colonel Joshua Chamberlain, during the Civil War and some decisions he had to make. Well, there's another person from another American battlefield that if I have some time, I might talk about him at the end of this block here. And that's Captain Donald Brooks. His era was the Vietnam conflict and how he showed great leadership and servant leadership, which is really the theme of where I was going with my leadership thing. In the meantime, I'd like to take a few minutes and let's look at some things that are in the news today. We see that the Kyle Rittenhouse jury has the case. Now, this case will either be resolved quickly or it could go on for days and days and days. The judge dismissed one of the gun charges against him because it didn't fit the understanding that anybody had. And this is something that the judge who came out and said, I don't understand the law. And I'm a legal person. I'm legally trained. And I don't understand this Wisconsin law about what age you can have what weapons. So when I read that article and the words of the judge, I had a feeling that he was probably going to toss that charge. Because if the judge can't even decipher what the wording meant in the law, how do you expect a 17-year-old young person to be able to decipher the law? And Rittenhouse seemed to know the law. When he was asked, why did you buy a rifle? Why didn't you buy a pistol? He says, I'm not old enough to have a pistol in Wisconsin. The law says you have to be 18, and I wasn't 18. I was old enough to get a rifle, so that's what I got. Which was interesting that the prosecutor asked those questions. So we're going to see how this is going to come out. I know that they're moving National Guard troops into place. Where was the National Guard when Kenosha, Wisconsin was burning from the rioting? Where was the National Guard called in by the governor when the city was under attack by groups of people who were out there destroying it, which made a person like Kyle Rittenhouse feel like they had to go out there and protect the city, right? But they're out there now because people are going to riot. Why would they riot? Well, if the kid's found not guilty. How dare he come out and try and stop us from doing what we were doing, our legitimate protesting and burning and looting and destroying to make our point. And how dare he come out here to stop it? And then he gets attacked. And how dare he defend himself? Right? So it's interesting how this might go. You know, I've been talking with the other law enforcement people about this and how they see it. And there seems to be a consensus on the part of many law enforcement, not all. And you might be one of those law enforcement officers that disagrees. You know, we talked about this kid being at the location with a gun. There's nothing illegal about it. It might even be a moral obligation we all have as citizens to protect our town if our political people pull away the protection, like the law enforcement, like they did in Kenosha. Then it's kind of up to us citizens, isn't it, to protect our communities and our families and stand up? And that's what this kid apparently was trying to do. Well, some people have the opinion that because it was not a wise move to be out there with the gun, that therefore he's got to suffer the penalty of what comes. And that's not true. It may not have been wise to be out there. I would not have advised my sons or daughter, I know you're upset, but take your gun and go out into the community and do what you're going to do and be careful out there. I would not have advised my kids that. But that doesn't change the fact that just because he did something maybe that we could consider unwise, maybe morally correct, but unwise, that makes him guilty of murder, first-degree murder. First-degree premeditated murder. He went out there, see, because he had the gun, people are saying, well, that tells you there was his premeditation. He thought he was going to go out there and kill people. No, that's not really how it works. A lot of people have guns in their house, and if somebody breaks in, they shoot them to protect their family. That's not premeditated murder. That is justifiable homicide if you're protecting your family from an intruder, right? Well, this kid was out there. He was legally allowed to have the gun. I saw something in the news reports. The one kid that he shot in the arm, the guy, 36-year-old guy, that he shot in the arm, who survived and testified, that guy admitted he pointed a Glock handgun at Rittenhouse, and that's when Rittenhouse shot him. It turns out this kid apparently has some felonies in his background. How come nobody's wondering how come this felon had a handgun with him? He admitted on the stand that his permit had expired, his permit to carry had expired. And I don't want to go into the details, and I'm not going to use his name because I'm not 100% sure of everything that came out there. But why is this guy running around with a handgun at a protest? What was he out there to do? If he had every right to carry it, then he had every right to carry it. But why was he running up the street pointing it at Kyle Rittenhouse? What was the purpose of the attack on Kyle Rittenhouse? What did he do to them other than put out a dumpster fire that he was trying to protect from the arson? And they didn't like that. And that's why they came after him. Well, some other people are gathering outside the courthouse as this is going to the jury now, were the McCluskeys. Now, you remember them? They lived in a gated community in St. Louis. And there was protesters going on and rioting going on. And to get to their property, you had to go through a gate, a metal gate, to get in there. And these protesters and rioters opened the gate and started marching towards their house. Well, they saw the rioting, the looting, the burning. And then here comes these crowds of people. So they assumed that their house was in danger. Their lives were in danger. And they went out front of their home with their legal handguns and an AR-15. And they wanted to ward off the protesters. How dare they defend themselves? Those protesters had some righteous things to be upset about, right? They didn't like something, and therefore you have no right to defend yourself from the righteous belief of the protesting mob. Well, they didn't think so. They think they had a right to protect themselves in their home, and they went out there. They were arrested, and they were charged, and eventually charges were dismissed, and they were pardoned by the governor. Now, that was a political attack on them. Well, just like this Rittenhouse thing is a political attack. And if they can do it to them, they'll do it to you. And that's the purpose of a political attack, to let us all know, you better not do this. You better just do what you're told, or we'll come after you as well. So I found that entire situation to be strange and bizarre. But we're going to see how this comes out. We're going to see if there's going to be more rioting. Is there going to be more looting and burning and anger because this kid dared to defend himself? And maybe a jury can see through the nonsense of the political attack on this kid. It's terrible that two people died. It's absolutely horrible. I wish they hadn't died. I'm sure Kyle Rittenhouse wishes they hadn't died. But they shouldn't have attacked this kid. That's the lesson here. You don't attack someone. Don't attack people, and then you won't get hurt most of the time, because he didn't shoot anybody who didn't attack him. So we're going to see how this is going to come out. I'm willing to listen to what the jury has to say, and maybe they saw it differently, and they can enlighten us all into something they saw in all of that testimony that would make this different in how it's supposed to come out. I don't know. We're seeing the political season heat up. Let's take a minute and let's do a little the political season is about to heat up, because we have less than a year now until the 2022 elections, where one of two things is going to happen. One of two things. Let's ring the bell now. Let's remember this date. Let's look at this show and say one of two things. Either the American people will realize that left-wing policies are detrimental to their best interests and the interests of their families and to our nation as a whole. Socialism, communism, no matter how it's done, no matter who does it, no matter how much money you throw at it, is never going to work when it's mixed in with freedom and liberty. You can't have both. You can't have freedom and liberty and socialism and communism. They are antithetical to each other. And people think that they can, because they really don't know. You know, when you talk to people, well, they do it over in Norway. In Norway, it's perfect. Everyone has perfect health care. Everyone has perfect everything. They could do it there. They're socialists over there. They have freedom. Well, I remember I had told you all a story. We met a family whose daughter met a man online from Norway. And she went over to Norway and married this guy and lived there. And she thought it was going to be a utopia. Free healthcare, free housing, free this, free that. Everything's good. They're best of everything. And she was there for 2 years and she realized, wait, there's a lot of rules here about this free stuff. She didn't make enough money, but she wasn't there long enough to be allowed to work a second job. So, oh, wait a minute, you're allowed? Yeah, you're only allowed to work one job, which means you live on the income you have, which wasn't a lot. There was a gasoline allotment she was allowed to have. And once you ran out of that gasoline, you rode a bicycle or you walked, because that's how they kept it down. 70-something percent of her income was taken by the government to pay for all the free stuff. So much so that she came home and says she's not going back. Well, this is the lessons that we learn. There's an artist out there, a Chinese artist, and I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but it's Wei, so I think it's Weiwei. And he made some confusing statements, I think, how they came out in writing that they're confusing about freedom and liberty. He came out and he said, when he sees America right now, people don't realize that a lot of the things that they're hearing now about wokeism and the controls they're putting on people and the mandates for the vaccine and all that, it's very much like Mao Zedong when he came out with his Cultural Revolution. And every night he would broadcast new rules and new things to purge the people of their bourgeois lifestyles. Well, our friends on the left believe the exact same things. And this guy, Weiwei, I don't know how to pronounce it. His point is pretty clear, that America doesn't see what they're doing. Now, he was comparing Donald Trump's tweets that he did late at night with Mao Zedong's daily edicts that he would put out. And of course, the reporter, who was a left-wing reporter, was like, oh, because you see Trump as a tyrant, right? And this is where it got confusing. When I read it all the way through and I read it a couple times, it sounded to me what the artist was saying was that not that Trump is was an authoritarian, but authoritarians do things like that late at night. They put out their edicts so that they get right to their people. Well, the edicts that Trump wasn't putting out edicts in the middle of the night. He was putting out his opinion. He's the president and he had access to the American people and he made his points known. He wasn't coming out with edicts of how we have to live or what you can't do or what you can do. So in that way, I thought he was confusing, probably in the way it was written. You know, it was probably written with a bias that wanted to make Trump look like he was comparing him to Mao Zedong. But we know that Trump is not that. Right? He is not that. He might be bombastic, he might be loud, he might be crude, but he's certainly not a dictator. What we're seeing now are dictators, people who are ignoring the Constitution completely, people who are completely removing any responsibility they have to liberty and freedom in order to pursue their agenda. And again, like we say here all the time, you know, it's policy that we have to worry about, how people, what policies they put together, what things they think are the right things for all of us that could cost us our freedom and our liberty. And we're seeing it every day. It's pretty funny. There's a couple of other points. There's a place called Oroville, California. Oroville, California. Interesting place. They have just declared themselves a constitutional republic. They said, we are a constitutional republic, and this is all in response to the tightening, the socializing of everything in California, the mandates, the rules, the masks, the taxes, everything that's out of control because of left-wing policy. That's what's causing all the problems there. But recently we saw Ryan Guillier, I'm trying to say his name right, Ryan Guillier, he's a state representative from Texas. He is a Democrat. And he has just come out and announced that he's going to switch parties and he's going to switch over to the Republican Party because he says the Democratic Party has gone so far to the left that it's impossible to live in Texas under these the Democratic rules and policies of what's coming to many of these cities, this liberalizing of the cities, the socializing of the cities, where rules don't count, especially down on the border with thousands and thousands of people cruising across the border, unstopped, unfettered. It's causing damage and difficulty to the people in these border towns, right? They're actually suffering. And this guy, Ryan Guillier, G-U-I-L-L-E-R, Guillier, I don't know. Again, I'm having trouble with pronunciations of people's names tonight, is that he is going to switch over to the Republican Party. So that's going to take Nancy Pelosi's, six-seat majority and knock it down to five. So she only has five, and then they have split in the Senate 50-50. So there's no mandate for any of this. There's no mandate for any of this left-wing politics that's going on. The only mandate that there is that the two parties work together and compromise, because it's basically a 50-50 split in the nation. When I think about that, and this is where, you know, I've gotten angry with the Republicans, many of the Republicans in the past, is that if they had a six-seat majority in the House of Representatives and a 50-50 split with the president and the vice president on their side, they would not have the guts to do any of the stuff that the people on the left are doing. They just wouldn't do it. You know, I would like to attribute it to, because no, they would be more righteous. And the reality is, it's not any of that. It's because they would not have the guts to do it. That's the problem. The Republicans don't fight back. They don't fight for you. They don't fight for me. A few of them do. And I always have to mention that, because it's not all. And there are some good ones out there. But they're far and few between. They have no voice. They have no power. And that is easily identified by asking yourself, when's the last time you saw a Republican press conference with all the Republican leaders there pushing back on this socialist agenda? Where? We had 13 Republicans vote for this gigantic $1.2 trillion wasted spending bill to give President Biden a boost, to give him a win when he's been losing on so many things. 13 Republicans crossed the aisle and voted for it. It's going to be good for my state. Well, what about what's good for your country? Right? What about what's good for your country? We don't see that taking place. And I just thought that was interesting. We're going to see Pat Leahy, senator from Vermont. He's a Democrat. He has said that he is not going to run for re-election. So that's going to be interesting. Which way is Vermont going to go? You know, Vermont, I guess there was a time that it was rock rib, red, white, and blue America. But not so much anymore, right? Now we have a lot of left-wing politics there. We have a lot of socialism there. It's a beautiful place, but it's going to be interesting to see who takes Pat Leahy's place. Another Democrat? Or will they lose that majority in 2022, even if it's by one vote? So we're going to take a little break right now, but we'll be back in a minute with more Chasing Justice. More to think about, more to talk about here on the America Out Loud Radio Network.
In 2008, the amount of concentrated time people could spend on a task without becoming distracted was 12 seconds. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds, 1 second less than a goldfish. If you find yourself always distracted or having trouble recalling information, you're likely to fall behind in the demanding, fast-paced 21st century. In other words, brain performance is more critical now than ever. Boost your brain power with Healthy Cells Focus Plus Recall. Science-backed nootropics to sharpen focus, concentrate longer, enhance recall, improve mental speed, learn rapidly, and be more alert. It's a pill-free brain supplement made with maximum absorption technology, designed to feed our brains at the cellular level. Take it for a test drive. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Focus Plus Recall. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
All right, everyone. Welcome back to Chasing Justice here in what we call segment two. Now, before I forget, I get so wound up and I get going on these topics, and it's probably going to happen again because that's the nature of Lieutenant Joe. I get involved in something and I start talking about it. I get passionate about these things. I've been telling you about healthy cell products. Right? I've been telling you about it. I never wanted it to sound like I'm doing a commercial for anything because I'm not. I'm trying to just pass on something that I found that's really good. I'm very happy that they're a sponsor of the station. I get nothing from it. But I told you I was looking for something to help me feel better, be better health, right? To boost my immunity is really what I was looking for, me and Miss Kathy. So we were trying to figure out what we could do when I heard the commercials on the station, because I listen to America Out Loud all the time. And I heard this on there, and I said, you know what, let me buy some. So I bought some, all right? And at the same time, Kathleen was saying she was having a little trouble sleeping, you know, so I also got the, what do they call it, the Healthy Cell REM sleep stuff. But I didn't have a REM sleep problem. I sleep like a baby. I go to bed, I go to sleep. But I've been taking the Healthy Cell. It comes in a plastic bag. I can't know how to describe it. It's like a little container. And you cut it open. You can mix it with water. You can mix it with juice, all kinds of things. Or you can take it straight. I take it straight. It's like a gel inside. I think it tastes really good. But anyway, I normally suffer from all kinds of sinus infections and little cold. You know, the ones that linger and linger and linger. You don't actually get sick. You just feel crappy. But since I've been taking this now for months, I have had hardly any kind of problems whatsoever. And the only thing I can attribute it to is the Healthy Cell. So I'm telling you, that's good. This past weekend, my cousin Steven, right? I told you about him. What I did with the REM sleep, Kathy decided that, you know, her sleeping problem wasn't really as bad as it was. It was probably just related to, you know, getting our life together as we're moving. We're empty nesters now. My youngest has gone off to college. So we're empty nesters and we're trying to, you know, resort our lives out here. So what I did with that REM sleep is that my cousin Steven, who's got to be, I don't know, he's in his 30s now. It doesn't seem possible that that young cousin is in his 30s, but and whoever thought I'd be 59. So I gave it to him because I heard him complaining on social media that he doesn't sleep. Well, I just saw him the other night and I said, hey, listen, I know you said that you were doing better. You were sleeping better, taking the REM sleep stuff. How is it really working? You know, are you really feeling? He goes, I'm telling you, dude, I haven't slept in the last couple of years. And since I've been taking that stuff, I can't believe I go to sleep. I fall asleep. And if I do wake up, I wake up, I'm up for a few minutes, and I go back to sleep. It has changed my sleeping function. So his cousin was here. We had a big family kind of reunion type of thing here. And his brother was here, my other cousin, Michael. And Michael says, really? Yeah, I know you've been having that problem for a long time. And he goes, dude, I'm telling you, this stuff really works. So I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen out there in Chasing Justice Land, that if you're having trouble sleeping, give this a try. Give it a try. You can't hurt. If it doesn't work, you move on. But I'm telling you, Steven says it really works, and I believe him. And I know the Healthy Cell Immune Boost has helped me. So I wanted to remember that, you know, this week. I keep wanting to tell you about it because it's a good thing, you know, and I'm very happy to be able to say something works. You know, you could buy so many things that don't work, and this stuff does. So let's move on from that. But I wanted to tell you, give you a little update on what's going on with Lieutenant Joe. So this whole leadership thing, you know, what does it mean to be leadership? And when I told you the story of Colonel Joshua Chamberlain, he was put in a very unique position to make decisions that affected, well, in reality, your life and mine and all of our families and our country and our nation. It was all put on one man's position and one decision he had to make in leadership. But there was a second guy I wanted to talk about, and this is Captain Donald Brooks. Now, Captain Donald Brooks served during the Vietnam era in our military. And for all of my brothers and sisters out there, American brother and sisters, who served during the Vietnam conflict, I want to thank you. I want to thank each and every one of you for your service. You know, you seem to be the only group of our service personnel that just never got the recognition that you deserve, that never got the thank you that you deserve. It was a strange time in our country when this all happened. You know, I remember being a little kid. In 1972, I was 10 years old. And my father was very pro-military, pro-America kind of a guy. And I remember watching the news, seeing our soldiers coming home from Vietnam, and people were spitting on them. And I said, Dad, why are they doing that to the soldiers? Because we had very high opinions of soldiers in this house. You had to, see it was they were given great reverence and appreciation. And my father's trying to explain this to a 10-year-old kid. Well, about the same time, in the same time period, I came home from school one day on the bus, and there's some neighbors down the end of the block here. And I didn't know them very well. I knew their youngest son. He was one of our neighborhood friends, played sports around with the kid, but I didn't know his older brother, Stanley. And one day I come by and there's this giant sign they put up in their front yard, "Welcome home, Stanley from Vietnam." And I was like, wow, holy moly. So I came home and at dinner, I said, hey, Mom, Dad, there's a boy named Stanley coming home from Vietnam. And my dad said, yeah, he's one of those soldiers we've seen on TV. He was over trying to, protect freedom around the world for America. And he's a hero. He's a hero, young Joe. So I took it on myself to make a poster that said, thank you, Stanley, for my freedom. I didn't really know what I was doing. All I know is my father thought this guy was an important guy. He thought the soldiers were important people. So therefore, I thought that, this is what happens in your home. When the message you give, echoes through your home, then people pick up on it. And I picked up on this. So I showed my mom and dad, hey, look at this poster I made. I want to give it to Stanley. And they said, this would be great. And we got in a car. We drove down the end of the block. We knocked on the door. And Stanley's mom answered the door. And she knew me from playing out in the street. We all played football and stuff in the different parts of the neighborhood. And she says, yes, what's up? And my father says, well, Joe made something for Stanley. Is Stanley home? She goes, yeah, Stanley's here. He's downstairs. Come on in. So we come on in. She says, and what did you make him? And I showed her this poster. And she was overwhelmed. The poor woman, she was so overwhelmed. She goes, oh, wait till Stanley sees it. And he came up. And here comes this young man, obviously much older than me. I was a kid. I was a 10-year-old kid. And up comes Stanley. And his mom explains, this is Joe. He's one of John John's friends. John John's was his younger brother. And he says, this is one of John John's friends. And he made something for you. And I said, yeah, I want to thank you for fighting for our country. I think that's what I said to him. I want to thank you for fighting for our country. And I made this poster for you. And basically it said the same thing as his sign. It said, welcome home, Stanley from Vietnam. Thanks for being a hero. Because my father had called him a hero. Well, the Stanley looked at this. And I remember him looking at his mother and then looking at me. And I was kind of, I don't want to say bewildered. That's not the right thing. I didn't know what to expect. Other than he'd say, oh, hey, thanks for the poster, kid. I appreciate it. And instead, what happened was his mother was crying. And then Stanley started crying. And it was kind of overwhelming, for a 10-year-old that all these people were crying. My mother and father had tears in their eyes. And he says, I have something for you. I have something for you. And he goes and he comes back and he gives me this beautiful, it was a silk pillow cover that said Vietnam on it and it had a big tiger on it. It was beautiful. And he gave me some coins and he hugged me and he thanked me. And, we stayed for a few minutes and then we left. And it was as I look back on it now, I know the amazing impact, not because of me, not because I did it, but any little kid could come up to somebody like that and say something like that. That would be a very powerful, powerful thing that somebody would say. And I'm glad I did it. I didn't realize the impact it would probably have on Stanley. I just thought it was a nice thing to say. I was trying to do the right thing. And apparently, when I talked to his mom later on, she said it moved him. It moved him very powerfully, and he really appreciated it. Unfortunately, Stanley has passed. At this point, he had some health issues. But, I never forget Stanley. I'll never forget him coming home. But that was the era, that Vietnam era, when these soldiers were over there fighting for our freedom. Whether you agreed with the concept of the domino effect or if you didn't, these men and women were drafted or they signed up to go over there and do battle with our enemies, right? Well, in the midst of all of this is where we see the story of Captain Donald Brooks. Now, Captain Donald Brooks was by all measures of everything that I've found out about him, is that he was a great leader. He was really a great leader, and he absolutely practiced the concept of servant leadership. He really believed, as I do, that the higher you go in any organization, the more you owe the people below you. It's your job to help them, right? I explained this on the previous episode. But what happened here with Captain Donald Brooks, you have to think of that time frame of conflict. The battle was raging on. Soldiers were dying every single day. People at home were fighting over whether we should be there or not. People were hating on the military and blaming individual soldiers for what they didn't like in policy decisions. And now, can you imagine to be over in a foreign country where you're fighting for your life every single day? Now, it's one thing to do this when you know that your entire country at home supports you and appreciates what you're doing and sees what you're doing as a tremendous good for the country and for everyone. So much so that we all understand there could be sacrifice. And we appreciate that people will make this sacrifice for our country, for our freedom, for our families and all that. Well, in Vietnam, a lot of that was missing. The people at home were not very good to those soldiers. Not everyone. Not everyone. There was a lot of people like my dad out there. A lot of people, I'm sure, out in this audience. A lot of families. But there were a lot of people in the country who had the sway of the media, who had the big mouths, who had the opportunity to put those soldiers down and what they were doing and put it down. Well, in the midst of all of this, we go out into the jungle, into the jungle where there was fighting going on, fighting every single day. The men would fight for days to win a hilltop, only to move on and abandon that hilltop and have to come back sometimes and fight for it again when the enemy retook it. Well, there was an outpost, a fire base, I believe they called them, out in the middle of nowhere, in the jungle. And the man who was running it, the commanding officer who was there at the time, was a very by-the-book kind of person. He believed if you followed those rules to the letter, no matter what, no matter whether they were difficult, no matter whether it hurt people, you followed them to the letter. And one of those things, the realities were that the soldiers in the jungle, because of the moistness, the dampness, the heat, and all the things that were going on, if you wore long sleeves and pants, you developed these lesions on your body. And the only way to get rid of these lesions was to expose them to salt water, air, or sunshine. Well, you're on top of a hill in the middle of the jungle. There's no salt water out there for you to clean yourself up with and get rid of these sores. The sunshine might have helped, but the commander at the time was concerned that if the soldiers wore short sleeves or wore short pants, they'd be out of uniform. And what if a general or his commanding officer came to that fire base and saw the soldiers out of uniform? Well, he would suffer personally, so therefore he didn't care how much it was hurting these men. He told them, you'll wear the long sleeves, you'll wear the pants, and you'll just deal with it. And that is the scene into which Captain Donald Brooks finds himself inserted. He was taking over command of that firebase. Now, Captain Brooks knew about the previous commander. He was informed about the soldiers and what was going on. He found out that they had all these lesions on their body from the humidity and this and that. And he lands and he goes to the base. The other guy leaves, and now he's in command of this base. And he's having a meeting with all of these men when he first gets there. And one of the very first things he does, after introducing himself, he said something about the lesions. He goes, I understand you guys have these problems here because of this weather and the way things are. I want you to take those jackets off right now, roll up your sleeves. You can put on short pants. You can cut your pants down. Whatever you need to do, let's get some sunshine on there. Let's clean those things up. Now, that was a tremendous act of leadership, of servant leadership, that Captain Brooks took it on himself to say, sure, my general could fly out here for some unknown reason and land at this firebase and be very upset that I allowed my soldiers to be basically out of the prescribed uniform of long pants and long sleeve shirts. But you know what? I'm willing to take that chance because they are suffering. And my job as the leader is to look out for them, to do what I can to make their lives better so that they can do their jobs. And he did the right thing. He told them, take those jackets off, get some short pants on, let's get some sun on, let's clear that up. Well, the men of that fire base were very appreciative of his concern for them and not Captain Brooks's career. He wasn't concerned with his own career. He was concerned with the men he was in command of. And there was a special not too long ago, I'm going to say 10 or 15 years ago, where there was a look back at Vietnam. And during that look back, they had talked about Captain Brooks and they found some of his soldiers. And they asked these people, hey, what'd you think of Captain Brooks? And almost to a man, every one of them was saying, he was the greatest guy in the world. I would go through fire for that man. He was a great man. And he was a great man. Why? You know, do we know anything more about him? I'm sure you could learn more about him. He was a great man because he did right by the people that he was responsible for. He didn't worry about his own career. Oh, if the general comes, I won't get the next promotion. He wasn't worried about that. He was worried about doing what's right for those men. And that is servant leadership, right? He was willing to take whatever came his way to do the right thing. So there's another great set of people out there who teach. If you ever get a chance to see Gallagher Westfall, that's the name, two guys, Gallagher and Westfall. I saw them at a performance for law enforcement one time, and it was a law enforcement leadership thing. These guys, their program is amazing. What they do is they're two retired law enforcement people, and basically they have a trailer filled with all their equipment, and one of them goes out for a week and does programs, comes home. The next guy takes the trailer, and he goes for a week. So they're a team, Gallagher Westfall. And he brought up something. I think I saw Mr. Westfold. That's the guy that I saw. And he was absolutely amazing, brilliant man, really inspirational. And one of the things he said, he gave us all a poster when we went to that class that he said, you could put this up on your wall in your office and it'll help guide you when you're making decisions. And as he explained it, the poster really had 4 points on it. That's all it had. And I have come to see that anyone in any position of leadership anywhere, that coach on the football team we talked about, a military person, law enforcement, the running your church organization, whatever you do, if you're in leadership, if you answer these 4 questions when you have to make a decision about something, it will help you to move forward. And what he asked was, are we doing the right thing? Is what we're about to do, whether it be discipline, policy change, hiring, firing, demoting, whatever we're going to do, is it the right thing to do? Is it at the right time to do it? Is it in the right way we're about to do this? And is it for the right reason that we're about to do it? So if you answer those 4 things, is it the right thing to do, the right time to do it, the right way to do it, and for the right reason, that will help walk you through a decision that you have to make as a leader. So with those 4 things in mind, let's look at Captain Brooks and what he did, and let's look for the leadership example here. So what he did, telling those men to take those jackets off and wear short pants, was that the right thing to do? I certainly think it was. You know, how can we have our military people out there suffering physically when they don't have to, when all they have to do is take their jackets and wear short pants, right? So that seemed to be a very simple thing. So was it the right thing to do? Was it at the right time? He did it when he first got there. He got there and he knew that this was a problem. So he did it right away. So I would say, yes, that was at the right time. Did he do it in the right way? He did it face to face with his men. He talked to them. He saw them. He saw the look on their faces. He understood what was going on. And he told them, take those things off. And the final one was, did he do it for the right reason? Yes, I think it's clearly he did it for the right reason, to relieve the suffering of people he was in charge of that had a job to do, a dangerous job to do, people who might get killed at any moment on that firebase, protecting freedom and liberty for you and me. And they were suffering unnecessarily, and he took the action to do what he did to watch out for them first. That is leadership. That is servant leadership. That is something you can do in any situation that you have to make a decision, right? Is it college for your kid? Is it picking one school over another? Is it something at work that you have to do? Is it the right thing at the right time, in the right way, and for the right reason. Thank you, Gallagher Westfall. You guys are awesome. I had that on my wall in my lieutenant's office, and there was another lieutenant who went with me, and he put his up. So we had two of them up on the same wall. It was kind of ridiculous, but we did it. But whenever we had to make a decision about anything, we would look at that thing and we'd say, hey, is this the right thing at the right time, the right reason for the right, you know, we would go through the four. And it became a kind of a mantra to help us. And that's really what leadership is all about. So as we look, you know, at leadership, and I'm glad I'm covering this again because there were some things I didn't get to. And I got a lot of emails and I got a bunch of texts from people that are saying, hey, finish up. You didn't finish up on the leadership. Finish up on it. So I wanted to add a little more today. Before I go off into some points about leadership that I wanted to cover, let's look at any of the stories that we talked about in segment one. Let's look at the Kyle Rittenhouse case and that being brought against that kid. Was that the right thing to do? To charge that kid because the mob demanded it? Was it done at the right time? In the right way? And for the right reason? See how you apply this to any one of those situations? All right, it's one of those things that we can look at over and over again. So that's how you use that, and I just wanted to bring that up. So one of the things that people say a lot is if they're in a position of leadership, and you don't have to be, you know, the leader of an army, or you don't have to be the leader of a big corporation. You can be the leader of your family. You can be the leader of your church group. You can be the leader of your softball team, right? Whatever it is, you can be some kind of a leader at work. There are things that we need to look at and see. So one thing people will say, well, I can't, nothing I do is going to make any difference. You know, I'm in a leadership position, but I'm a low-level leader. I'm not the high leader. I'm not the senior management people. I'm low-level management. And the first thing that I will tell you is this. You lead from where you are. All right, so if you think of the hierarchy of any organization, at the very top of the ladder, picture a ladder, the CEO, she's on the very top. The king of the country, he's on the very top up there, right? And then there's various levels going down of authority and leadership positions. What if you're on like that third rung out of 100? Can you make policy? No, you don't make policy. Can you change the game? No, you really can't change the game. You can suggest things. But what you can do is you can lead from where you are on that ladder. You can understand the mission of what your leadership wants, and you can help the people below you buy in to that mission. You help them by explaining why it's important to do whatever policy it is, or why it's important to behave in a certain way, or to do your work in a certain way. So leading from where you are on the ladder is extremely important, and that makes you important, right? Because everyone in a leadership position is important to their organization. You're important to the people above you, and you're important to the people below you. And it doesn't really matter where on that ladder you are. You want to strive to go higher? Good for you. But wherever you are, you have an important job to do, and you have to always remember that. What is it that I'm doing, and how do I do this? So I have a theory that I call the 85%. Now, I want you to think about any organization you're involved in, okay? Any organization you're involved in, whether it's work, school, anything. Doesn't matter what it is. The 85%. I posit this, 85% of everyone in an organization will do the absolute minimum they have to do to get by. They'll just do the minimum. I'm just going to do whatever my job requires. I'm not going to do more. I'm not going to think more. I'm not going to stay longer. I'm not going to mentor anybody. I'm just going to do what I have to do to get my check and get out of here, or do my obligation and get out of here. Then there are 10% of the people in the world, in any organization, that really want to do more. They want to do better. They want to make more of a difference. They just don't always know how. They don't have the training. They don't have the skill set developed. And they don't have people who are investing in them to make them better. Right? So they're kind of stuck there in that 10%. They really want to do more than the 85. They're just not always really sure how. And then you have the last group, the 5% group. This 5% group drags all the rest of us forward, right? You think about these people, the 5%, they drag us all forward. So are you an 85%er? Are you a 10%er or are you a 5%er? I try and tell people, you know, you should really strive to be a 5%er. Drag us all forward, you know? So when we look at this, we say, okay, well, can you become a better leader? Can you become a great leader, or are you naturally born? And we can look at all kinds of leaders over the years. And I think it's true. It can go either way. You can be a naturally born leader. Some people just have those skills built in, and they display them all the time, and you can see that they're clearly leaders. Then there's other people that can learn. We can all learn to be better leaders, because there are specific things you can do to be a great leader in your community, in your company, in your church, wherever you are. You can learn to be a better leader. Now, wouldn't it be great if our people in politics actually worried about being great leaders and not just being people who get paychecks and get to become millionaires for being there and doing things for them and for their benefit? Wouldn't it be great if they actually worried about being great? So when we look at our politicians, 85% of them really just want to do enough to get by and keep their office. They just want to get reelected, keep their office, keep their hands in the cookie jar, right? That's what they want to do. 10% of them really want to do better. They're just not really sure. They don't have the allies. They don't have the funding. They're not really sure. How do I not be, you know, the 85? What do I do? And then there's that 5%. And we can look at those 5% of people who really make a difference. So look at the politicians that you like and think about them. And who fits into that 5% group? I would say Senator Cruz fits into that group. I think Donald Trump fit into that group. He really wanted to do better. He worked hard to do things. You can disagree with what he did, but I think he really tried to do the right thing, and he did make some major differences positively for our country. You can look around and see who you pick out. You know, Jim Jordan, right? Here's a powerful guy out there doing the right thing, and they're trying to jerry-rig his district out from under him to get rid of him because he's one of them people. He's shaking up the boat, and they don't like that when the boat is shaking. So leadership comes to us, and we have to look at some traits. Here's some traits: knowledgeable, honest, credible, a proven record, intellectual, ethical, they're full of integrity, they're fair and they're articulate, confident, compassionate, approachable, caring, respectful, they are respected, they're responsible, resourceful, and open-minded. All right, so these are some important things, as opposed to some negative traits: self-absorbed, self-centered, narcissistic, overinflated ego, slick, sneaky, they blame others, they avoid responsibility, they abuse power, they show favoritism. They have questionable integrity, honesty, ability, work history. They're jealous of other people, they're credit seekers, they think they're better than everybody, and they're improperly critical. So out of those traits right there that I mentioned, good and bad, what do you think you have? Do you have the good ones, or do you have the bad ones? And I think a lot of us have some of both. I think sometimes we can all go, if I'm being honest with myself, I could be better in this area. It doesn't matter what area of your life it is. We can all be better, right? Nobody is perfect. So I bring up this leadership idea, this concept, you know, for a couple of episodes here, because we are lacking in leadership in our country. And I wanted us to take a minute to think about it. I wanted us to look around and see who are good leaders. So I gave you examples of great leaders. And I think if we start to think about it more, we'll demand it more, we'll be it more, we'll raise better leaders. Okay? So I just wanted to say that. And I'm glad you're out there listening to America Out Loud, because America Out Loud is a leader. It's a positive leader. It's a fantastic place for us all to be. So listen, this is Lieutenant Joe. I'm signing off for this episode. But we'll be back again very, very soon. Remember, be a part of the solution and not a part of the problem. Be a leader.